Hello, how are you? So glad to be here. My name is Swongile Machika. I am the commissioning editor at Jonathan Ball, or one of them at least. I'm so happy to be at PageCast. I've been wanting to do this for some time. Today I'm joined by two wonderful authors, Abby and Bronwyn, and we're going to have just a relaxed chat about how your day has been, how you're finding the festival, and what you've been up to today. So I'm going to start with Bronwyn. What have been your impressions? What have you enjoyed and what do you look forward to in the festival?
Blown away by how excited everybody is and the engagement with the audiences. It's really been wonderful. And I think that the most interesting part about the festival to me so far has been the mix of fiction and nonfiction and the way that it's been like blending together the sort of creative ways of thinking about the world. And I'm just really impressed by the panels that they've put together and by the audience engagement so far.
Oh, that's lovely. And Abby, do you just come from a panel? How was it? How are you feeling about the festival?
Amazing. I love it. This Franschhoek is so beautiful. I want to move here. So if anyone has a place for me to stay. amazing panel. Completely engaging conversations and audience. Everyone's really friendly. Really great questions. It just feels like I'm inspired and challenged and just so much love as well. Amazing food. I just have to throw in. The food is incredible.
Okay. So that was going to be my next thing. What have you enjoyed about the space? And maybe a follow-up question is that for both of you, what's been the weirdest sort of form of research you've done for any of your books or your work? If you could just elaborate on that.
Oh, the weirdest form of research. That's such an interesting question. I mostly work in archives, and I don't get around to talk to people very much. But actually in this book, I was really trying to, my book's called Africanomics, and it's like thinking about how people have tried to intervene in the continent. And I have this chapter where I was talking about money supply at the end of the 19th century, which sounds very dry and serious. Mm-hmm. And I just could not crack this one thing. And I read like four articles about it. And I was trying to figure out why this money and money supply worked the way it did. And I eventually decided to just go and interview some people, which is not really my normal style. Mm-hmm. I'm more of a, archive-based historian than an interviewing kind of journalist style. And so that was really fun for me to actually just get to go and talk to some experts and, interview them and figure out what was happening. And that was really fun.
There's a friend of mine who's a historian and she's like, the archives is like talking to the dead, except then you want to ask them more questions and no one can answer.
Exactly.
So you got to speak to people who can talk back.
Yeah.
And for you, Abby?
I don't know whether it's weird or anything, but it's just obviously because I write about rural Nigeria and, poverty. I write poverty with dignity, something I like to say. So going back to Nigeria and looking at it with a different lens. So I was in Lagos, so and I wanted to visit a very poor slum, right? And so everything is set on water, really stagnant, murky, black water. Like you could see your reflection, like almost mirror-like on the water surface. And so going on that in a Kano with my brother and I, and they're just two of us, my brother and I. So we didn't tell my mother because she would have a panic attack. And we're going right into the middle of the ocean. And it's not ocean as you think of it is, you know. And then going into a school that is set on stilts. And it's a small classroom that the teacher was teaching about 120 students and how she fit them in there, humid, hot, and seeing the joy on their faces. I think that I would never forget that for me. So it was wonderful. Well, my mother did have a panic attack when she found out. She sent her the videos afterwards.
You can't tell your parents in advance. You have to tell them only after that.
But I can't tell them. I think that's so cool. Because
But now she has to know. See it on social media. She might hear it. So I just thought, let me gently. She called me right away. Like, I don't think she finished the video watching it before she called me. But that was great to see.
Okay. And then another question is, how do you, and follow up on that, like, how do you navigate writing about Africa with dignity and with a kind of humanity that sometimes is not, as you say, there isn't dignity in writing about poverty. There's a kind of poverty porn that happens. And earlier on, we were talking about everywhere else is fire except in the US. So there's nothing and then there's another crisis.
Mm.
So how do you navigate talking about that in your work, or are you conscious of it?
I'm very conscious of it. So that's why I said I write poverty with dignity. So it's about the people for me. It's about the characters.
Yeah.
You know, when you meet my characters, the last thing you think about is their poverty. I show you that. But what you think is she's feisty, she's intelligent, she's brilliant, she's beautiful. She has so much to give. And then, oh, she doesn't actually have a lot of money. That's what I try to do. I show you the landscape because it's the reality, right? But I also try to consciously show you the wealth. So there's a nuanced view because I know that there are people that go into this book with one sort of one mind and one thinking about African poverty. So I then show you the wealth and show you the people that enjoy that so that you can see that they coexist side by side. So that's what I do.
And for you as a nonfiction writer?
Yeah, it's pretty similar. I mean, I think that there is a view, and this is one of the views that I'm trying to tackle in the book, that, you know, that Africa is poor, Africa needs fixing, people need to come in from outside and fix it. And that this is a really persistent view from the past 250 years. And what I'm trying to do in the book is show, actually, you know, it's much more varied than that. Mm-hmm. There is wealth in Africa. There's middle class Africa.
Yeah.
There is poverty for sure, but there's poverty in other places as well. And poverty is not, you know, as I think many of the characters in my book think that poverty is a lack of knowledge.
Yeah.
When in fact it's just a lack of money, right? And actually, these people have lots of knowledge and they have lots of experience and lots of expertise in different ways. And so, it's great to hear about it in a fiction context. And I think actually, you know, we're all working to the same goal, which is to like expand people's minds and thinking about, this idea of poverty with dignity is a great way of putting it.
I was saying earlier that I love the subtitle of your book, A History of Western Ignorance. And I think it's an interesting time now where everything else that was happening in other parts of the world, and perhaps I think it's the first time where the West is kind of being shown that, oh, some aspects of the West, you have poor people too.
Mm.
You have ignorant people too. Mm. You have people of varying types as well.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting to think of it and see it play out in that way. And another question I have is that for both of you, then, do you see your work as a cultural product, obviously, but do you see it as a kind of almost political developmental work in terms of what you're doing into people's minds and ways of thinking and what you're contributing to each of your genres from Lack of Another Series?
So with The Girl with the Loud Voice, the first book, I certainly didn't go in thinking that. I just wanted to get a distinction in my master's, which is why I wrote the book.
Good goal.
And then I began to see people reading it. Like, I remember I once got an invitation to speak at the British Parliament to talk about gender-based violence during COVID-19 and women and girls because of Aduni.
Yeah.
And then I began to realize, oh my goodness, I'm in trouble here. What have I done?
How of the pain.
So now with Ansoiro, I'm a little conscious of that. I don't think it's a good thing. I want to be free to be able to write about people and issues about people and not think about who might be reading this. Because I think it restricts your creativity and I want my creativity to be free. But I'm conscious of that. And I know that people read my books with the political worldview. But I also use that in a way to actually highlight the potentials and say to the government very, very subtly, you know, look at what you've caused and look at what you could do.
Yeah.
And so in a way, so I use it as a weapon as well, as a way to say to whoever's reading this that can make a change, an influential change, a positive change in the communities, go out and do that.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, I mean, it's coming from a quite different perspective, but similar kinds of goals. I think with the research that went into Africanomics actually is really drawing on a lot of the research that has been going on about African economic history, which has been, I think, unfortunately quite siloed, not by the fault of the people doing the research, but because, you know, academic research is produced in a particular context for a particular audience. And so a big goal of Africanomics was actually to bring some of that research to a wider audience by telling it through stories, through these, like, you know, individuals who are having these encounters and the kinds of mistakes that they're making in these encounters, but by, you know, grounding it in a personal experience, helping people to see themselves in those people, but also to get that wider research that people have been doing to a bigger audience, and, you know, outside of those silos of academia where like we've made really great progress. We don't actually think about Africa in these ways anymore, but I don't know that that necessarily Everyone gets communicated. Else, yeah. Yeah.
Both of you speak about the characters in your book in very real terms. And so is there anyone in your own books or in characters in your own books or in other books that if you could have dinner with, who would it be and why?
It'd have to be Adjuni. I mean, as much as I feel like I know her. Yes, because I know, like, she has so much wisdom to give and she's so funny and just, you know, just a brilliant, brilliant human. Okay. And she feels very real to me. So her. Definitely.
Where would you go?
I don't know. Maybe a nice restaurant. Maybe I'd love to sort of introduce her to, like, I love Chinese food and Asian food. So it would be interesting to hear her take. I'm sure she'll come up with something really insanely witty about the food and all that.
Yeah, so, for her to react to the meal and absolutely. The flavor. And for you, Ronan?
I don't know. I probably have like many answers. But in terms of my characters in my book, you know, there are all these like really well-meaning people who arrive with these good intentions to fix Africa across the centuries. And I think the person in the book who is actually in there sort of as an anomaly, he's not somebody who's actually arriving with good intentions, is the British explorer and diplomat Richard Francis Burton, who's just an absolute jerk. I mean, just the worst kind of person. And he's just so... I mean, just so immoral and just so gross. And I would love to take him to dinner somewhere and maybe somewhere really not very reputable and give him some food poisoning.
Oh, my gosh. That was a plot twist.
Yeah.
He's just somebody who I have encountered over and over again in my research. And he's just this character who has just the most condescending views. And I just think he really needs his comeuppance. And actually, I mean, one of the fun parts about writing that chapter in which he's the character is that he does really get his comeuppance.
Okay.
I won't spoil it, but yeah, he gets served. So, but I would love to be there and watch it happen.
Okay. And then having been here, having seen some panels, hopefully, and you've been on some, who is your front chook crush in terms of authors, if I may ask?
Well, I sat on a panel with John Boyne and Sven. I don't know his surname, but both of them are so amazing. And Sven was just emotional and funny and fresh. And yeah, both. Can I have both?
Yes, you can. Yes. You can have as many crushes as you like.
So I have to say that I'm an absolutely huge Jeon Maer fan. And I would love to spend some time with him at the festival. I think I'm going to actually miss his panel tomorrow because it was like sold out, obviously. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to be there. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of his series.
If you weren't an author, what would you be doing instead? Can you imagine being something other than an author?
I can, because I was. Yes. I mean, I spent 15 years working in technology in the UK. Felt like wearing the wrong size shoes. Uncomfortable, but necessary. But now being an author and loving it so much, I think I might, if I wasn't an author, I might be a speaker. I do speak quite well, and I enjoy speaking and teaching as well. I coach
really?
Other writers.
Ah.
So I enjoy that.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's such a hard question because I feel like, you know, we're also privileged to be doing this job and it's so wonderful. And I can't really imagine enjoying something else quite as much. I think there was a time, my mom is a cellist, and there was a long time when I really wanted to be in like arts marketing.
Oh, wow.
And I think like, you know, getting... This was a very particular interest, but getting classical music to wider audiences was like a real is something that I'm really passionate about. So probably if I had a different timeline, that might be something I would end up in.
You like doing hard things.
I know. It would make it easy for myself.
What do you not enjoy the most about being a writer?
I think now it's not knowing and not being in control of reader reaction. That's the hardest thing. I love writing. I love especially when it's like when I know what I'm writing. So not knowing what to write is a problem. But then knowing what you write and really loving it and then not being able to control what happens after that. Like you're so out of control. And it feels like you're free falling. That's a feeling. You don't know if you're going to land.
Okay. No.
Totally. Yeah. Can totally appreciate that. I think for me, it's like the 5 minutes after you've sent off the manuscript are the best 5 minutes in your life. And then the like next 3 weeks when you're like, wait, do I have a purpose? What am I doing now? What am I doing with my life? What's my next project? I have to find a next project. That's horrible.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with it.
And then on that, what are you working on? If you are allowed to share.
I don't know. I'm working on what I'm working on. I say that because, you know, you work on something and then you get to somewhere and you think, this is not working.
Yeah.
So I will have to wait and see.
I don't know if I believe you. That sounds like you'll know when I'm allowed to tell. Yeah, there'll be an announcement.
Maybe there's that.
There's what I'm supposed to be working on, which is another book another nonfiction book, which I am actually really looking forward to writing about a sort of alternative history of global humanitarianism, the sort of south to north through history, south to south, like working against the grain. But what I'm actually spending my time doing is writing probably a very terrible novel.
As long as you're still writing.
Yeah.
I would ever write a novel. So you've answered that question.
Would you ever write nonfiction?
Yes, I would.
All right. Okay. You can be fantastic
at writing
nonfiction.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you, guys. I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thank you for coming to have a chat
and a drink with me.
Thanks so much.
And thank you to the podcast team. Paige Koss, thank you so much.